This episode is brought to you by T.R. Crandall. T.R. Crandall is one of the finest vintage guitar shops in the country, and they offer top-notch repair and restoration work to boot. Whether you are looking for a 1941 Martin 00045, which they happen to have, a Banner Gibson, or a new Milkman amplifier, they have you covered. Go to trcrandall.com and tell them the Fretboard Journal sent you. Welcome to the Fretboard Journal's 132nd podcast. I'm Jason Verlinde, the editor of the Fretboard Journal magazine. Today we are talking all about singer-songwriter Elliott Smith with Portland's amazing audio engineer Larry Crane. If you don't know who Elliott Smith is or what his music was like, I encourage you to stop what you're doing and go to iTunes or Spotify or wherever you go for music and check out his songs. There's also a great documentary on him that you can order called Heaven Adores You. He's probably best known for his songs on the Good Will Hunting soundtrack and for being the awkward guy in the white suit who performed at the Oscars with just his acoustic guitar. But his impact went way beyond that for a lot of us, myself included. He was a huge influence on me personally. At a time when I was really into loud electric guitars and indie rock, Elliott Smith showed me not only how powerful great songwriting can be, but also how great acoustic guitar playing can be, and his music and his playing has definitely stood the test of time. Larry spent a ton of time with Elliott Smith. They go way back. He is the owner-operator of Jackpot Studios, among other things, and Elliott Smith actually helped him build Jackpot Studios, which is a cool story you will hear about. Larry is also the co-owner of the incredible Tape Op magazine, one of the world's great independent magazines. It's all about the art of recording, both in studios and at home. And if you live in the United States, it's totally free to subscribe to, so you should. Larry worked on many of the essential Elliott Smith records and was a collaborator on the new 20th anniversary edition of Either Or, which is coming out this March. You can pre-order that now, I believe, on Amazon and iTunes. And when I heard that that was coming out, I figured it was a great excuse to talk to Larry finally on this podcast. We talk about Smith, those recording sessions, Smith's Yamaha FG-180, which I think is the same exact guitar model that Nick Drake played for a while, and a lot more. In other news, here in Seattle, our 38th issue is printing right now. If you want to subscribe to the Fretboard Journal magazine or have thought about it, please do so in the next week or so. You can get 4 issues for $40 or 8 for $75 at fretboardjournal.com. We can start you off with this next issue. You'll get it with all the other subscribers and a nice cardboard mailer. Leo Kottke's in this issue, as well as a great long feature on luthier Ken Parker and a bunch more. As a reader-supported magazine, all of your subscriptions do matter to us and help us expand our podcast, print, and digital efforts with minimal advertising. So that's our spiel. I am headed to NAMM next week. We'll be posting updates and highlights throughout the weekend on our Instagram page, which is just Fretboard Journal, one word. If anyone has any special requests or instruments, or maybe you want to hang out for a little bit, by all means, drop me a line at jason@fretboardjournal.com, and we'll do our best to cover as much as we can. I know we have a ton of meetings. We'll also be posting some photos to Facebook, but I think Instagram is going to be the place where you'll get as many updates as possible. And I guess I should remind you, if you haven't left us a review on iTunes, please do so, and please subscribe to the Fretboard Journal podcast on iTunes or Stitcher or however you do it. All those things add up to us and help us grow. Without further ado, here is Larry Crane talking about Elliott Smith. All right, so Larry, thanks for being on the Fretboard Journal podcast. I've known you for a long time. I'm a big fan of Tape Op and all the work you do. There's obviously this big, I guess it's what, the 19th anniversary of Elliott Smith's Either Or, maybe the 20th?
20 years. In 1997 was when Either Or came out, and it was also when Elliott helped me build the Jackpot recording studio here in Portland, so kind of a lot going on.
Yeah, let's go back. How did you guys know each other?
I get asked that a lot, and it's always hard to remember exactly, because it's sort of like when I moved to Portland in 1993, and I remember seeing Heat Miser a few times and not really digging it. I was kind of burned out on the sort of post-grunge sort of loud guitar bands and stuff, and I was like, oh God, not another one. I mean, I remember actively telling friends, like, I don't want to see that band again or something. But and I reviewed actually a record and EP that were out at the time for a local magazine, and And I said, I was kind of disparaging. I'm pretty sure I've never found the review. I've looked for it for years, but, you know, and I've certainly come to reverse my opinion on all that, but, but, you know, I would see Elliot around. It's, you know, like any music scene, you know, it wasn't like I moved here also, by the way, like it wasn't like I moved here out of the blue. It was like, I had been up here playing shows since like 87 at Satyricon and a Blue Gallery and some of the venues around Portland. So, we'd played with some of the local bands like Calamity Jane and Cracker Bash and the Dharma Bums. And all those bands were just really awesome and friendly. And when I moved here, that kind of fell into that circle of people to a degree, you know, just by happenstance, the house I moved into out of the blue, John Moen, who was the drummer for the Dharma Bums, was working for my roommate, you know?
Crazy.
So I just started seeing everybody around and going to the shows. I mean, one of my favorite bands back then was Cracker Bash, which were just a great noisy. They were much, you know, when I say I didn't like the loud guitar bands, I did like the ones that were weird or intense. and that was good. Definitely one of them. It was more like an unhinged Fugazi or something. And so, yeah, I remember probably a lot of it revolves around La Luna, because there were a lot of shows there and we were always going to shows there. And Joanna Bome, who now plays bass with the Jicks, Stephen Malkmus, was a bartender there. And I had some other friends that were bartenders there. And so you just kind of get to know the people that were always there. And in fact, the bar manager at La Luna for the bar, the downstairs and upstairs bars, was this guy named Tim. Tim had run the Blue Gallery before, and it always like brought us up to play and stuff like that. Tim Brooks was his name. And so, you know, he knew, hey, Larry from Vomit Launch, you know, it's like, you moved here, cool. And so that just kind of all fell together. And I mean, along the way, it was just sort of like, oh, there's Elliot, you know, and there's Elliot and Joanna or things like that, you know.
Yeah.
And the one thing I always remember and always comes up when I get interviewed is really the first time we sort of hung out. He was at a party at my house and we were all sitting in the backyard and he said, hey, could I see your home studio? And we went into the basement where I'd had a place called Laundry Rules Recording. And he was like, oh, my console's broken. He had a little Mackie 1604 mixer. He's like, I might need to come over and do some overdubs. And we had the same exact 8-track reel-to-reel tape deck, a Tascam 38, and which was pretty unusual that we would both have the same one. But the next week or something, he called up and was, hey, can I come over? I just need to do these vocals for one song. And we ended up working on Pictures of Me, did all the vocals for that over. He had a 8-track reel-to-reel, of course, and then there was a stereo mix of the music that he and Rob and Tom had done as producers, Rob Schnapp and Tom Rothrock. And then we just recorded 6 tracks of vocals on top of that, you know. And I thought it was excessive. I'm like, you sure you need to do all those vocals?
How many Elliot Smith tracks did you actually record or kind of have a hand in?
You know, for either or for later on?
For anything, yeah.
Anything? Yeah. You know, I don't know, because as far as released things, early on it was that song, Pictures of Me, which if you look at the liner notes, I'm not exactly credited for. It just says recorded at Laundry Rules or something, and a thank you to me. I mean, that was the first thing for sure. And then after that, about six months later, he helped me open Jackpot Recording Studio, and immediately we worked on a version of Division Day that didn't get. We couldn't beat the one that actually ended up coming out on a Suicide Squeeze.
Mm-hmm.
And so he used the one he'd recorded before. But, you know, we worked on demos for a lot of the songs on EXO, and some of them, like Amity, actually came, you know, got transferred over and overdubbed on in L.A. From my original tracking. And then also Baby Britain, which I was mistakenly credited as having recorded. That was actually recorded by Joanna Bome, who Elliot and I were both kind of helping her get her feet, you know, in the, on the ground as far as engineering and stuff. And honestly, one of the reasons a scenario like that would happen is because I was working like nonstop, and then Elliot would come into town, or, you know, it was always seemed like he was coming off a tour or something. Mm-hmm. And he'd be like, can you help me record something? And I'm like, I've worked for the last 28 days in a row, man. You know, so, hey, why don't you get Joanna to help you, you know, which looking back, I mean, the things I was recording were probably 75% incredibly unimportant. And, you know, but, you know, it was the kind of thing, like, I mean, I think that the miking and stuff for Baby Britain was all stuff I'd left set up from another band, even, as I know the drummers told me that and stuff, that he's like, those weren't even my drums. And I'm like, oh my God. It was probably some other session that we were just piggybacking on. And I took photos that there's a bunch of photos I took of that exact day, which is really funny, like of Joanna and Elliot and Paul Pulverenti, who was the drummer on that. I'm also uncredited on XO. There's a lot of missed credits out there. But, you know, we worked on a lot of demos. We like the waltz number one, there's a demo version that's out there legitimately released. There's an unreleased demo for waltz number two, the kind of the hit off of XO, demos, several different demos for Bled White and Miss Misery, of course, was tracked right in that same time. And that ended up the exact version that we tracked and I got credited as co-producer on was the one that got mixed by Rob and Tom and then used in Good Will Hunting, of course, and nominated for an Oscar. Nominated for a goddamn Oscar.
So go back a second. You said, you know, when you guys built Jackpot, he literally helped you build Jackpot, right?
Yeah. There's photos on our website of him, you know, painting and drywalling. He was actually, he had a whole, all the tools to do a mudding and taping, you know, for drywall.
Sure.
And he'd been doing that, him and Pete Krebs actually had been doing that professionally. Around town just as a side job, you know, between playing music, obviously. And so he had all the tools and he was really, mudding and taping is one of the few, well, I'm not an expert at anything, but it's one of the construction things I'm really sloppy at. And so it was really great to have someone in there that just knocked it out and made it look so clean.
So these recordings, I mean, all of Elliot's recordings, you know, hit you like a ton of bricks and they have this intensity. Mm-hmm. What was he like in the studio when you were with him?
I mean, it's so funny to describe because it was almost always so efficient. And so first of all, I think one of the things, you know, you hear stories about Brian Wilson having songs really written in his head and stuff. Elliot's the closest I've ever seen to that. You know, he would come in and be like, you know, give me a click track. And he'd go over and he would play like piano or guitar or drums or something and play the whole song down, then play the next instrument, maybe erase one. If he did a guide guitar, he might erase it and put a new one against the drums, you know, tighten it up. I mean, but really, if you look at a song like Miss Misery, I think it was honestly maybe 2 or 3 hours of recording the instrumental. And then, you know, an hour or two doing vocals later after he took a cassette of that with him on the road or something and then came back and sang it. You know, so definitely the thing to say is it was never like dramatic or anything. It was very workmanlike. I mean,
surgical.
This is a guy that worked. Yeah, he just knew what he needed to do. I mean, the only parts he didn't know were he didn't have written out. And I think he probably would have or started getting there would be his vocal harmonies. He would know he wanted a harmony, but he didn't have the exact notes like mapped out. And so he'd say, open up a track, don't record it. And I'm going to sing along and find some notes. And he called it sending out a probe every time. It was his joke. And you can hear that when I was working on New Moon later on, you can hear, I would open up some track and it was so great that I'd worked with him, you know, because I'd open up some vocal track and I'm like, that's kind of weird. And I'm like, oh, he recorded that one. So he recorded that one pass of sending out a probe, you know, and there's one song that has a couple little harmonies in it. It's just the ones that were good, you know, where I just popped them in and out for those spots. So he just had a system, you know, he told me once, he said, I don't really care for the tours and the interviews. And all those kind of things. I want to write songs and I want to record songs.
Yeah.
You know, that was his focus, you know?
And for all the acoustic guitar stuff, was it always that Yamaha?
You know, sometimes, yeah, it was that, and other times there's some stuff we did, because if he didn't have his stuff with him, he'd use what was laying around. So I know, like, my old bass, my old Aria, oh my God, what is it, a Pro Stray Cat 2 or some horrible name. It's this Japanese bass I bought in 87. He would grab that. I know that's on Miss Misery and a few other things. And also I have an Ibanez acoustic guitar. Let me see if I can find out what kind it is too, because that ended up on a lot of odds and ends here and there, just because it was always around the studio, you know.
Yeah,
like if something was laying around, it would get used. He even used a Casio guitar at one point. We had you ever seen those Casio guitars with the rubber there's a demo of Bled White where he does this amazing little thing and his little figure, and when he went to record the XO album in Los Angeles, he's like, hey, can you ship that thing down to me? And I'm like, dude, it just broke. it wasn't working anymore. It was so disturbing. Let's see, you know, I can't remember which one it is. An Ibanez M310, I think, is the acoustic that I've had for years. I have to look it up.
Did he just have the one Yamaha, or were there several in his stable?
I just remember the one. I think later on he might have had a different, you know what I mean? He might have had a couple or something, because they weren't expensive, were they?
I think it's the FG180, which some people think is actually the same guitar Nick Drake used for his recordings. So I don't know.
Oh, that's weird. Yeah. Well, that would make sense.
Yeah.
Swear to God, the first time I heard Roman Candle, I said, oh, this guy likes Nick Drake, huh?
yeah, exactly.
That's funny.
Yeah, no, I know he's photographed with the Guild, but Nick Drake definitely had a Yamaha, and some argue that's what he used all the time. So who knows?
Well, you know, I've got a really cheap one, an F325, you know, it was like $150 or something. And we strung that up as a Nashville, you know, guitar for the studio. And one of the reasons I bought it is because I was always like, well, Elliot's Yamaha sounded fine, you know. And you get that. I mean, obviously, if you look at the guitar list for my studio, you see a whole bunch of Japanese acoustics and stuff here. And one of the reason is that's the first place that started, you know, mass producing, but with, you know, pretty strict quality control. You know, Yamaha would be a great example of that, you know. And I think a lot of times, you know, we get really, there's brands, you know, Martin has made, and Taylor and all these companies have made some great guitars over the years. But if you don't have a lot of money and you want something decent for, especially for a recording studio where 90% of the time no one sees it, you know, then you can always save some money and buy some of these mass production ones. And what I've done a lot is take them to a luthier, and it's like for the Nashville strung Yamaha, it's got, you know, new nut and bridge cut and everything set up for it. And, you know, so you just fine tune these guys a little bit.
Yeah. What was your setup mic wise with Elliot? Do you remember?
Back then, you know, what's funny is like when I interview people for Tape Op, I'm always like, wow, how'd that guy remember his mics that he used from, you know, 40 years ago? And then you realize you had 8 mics. So, and so, you know, like I could probably figure out every mic we used, say, on Miss Misery. And I am pretty certain that the acoustic guitar mic is, we each had one each of this mic called a Pro 37R by Audio Technica. And they're like about $130 back then. It's just a small diaphragm condenser, and I'll tell you, I'm pretty sure that's what the drum overheads are, the piano in stereo, and also the acoustic guitar. You know, this is really, really affordable mic.
That's pretty wild.
I know. And there's some other recordings I did later that I don't think any of them have been released, because it was while he was working on XO, and he dropped by Jackpot in between being in LA, and we knocked down a bunch of songs. But at that point his contract was with DreamWorks or Universal now, and so we tracked a few songs, and I had just bought a Manly cardioid reference microphone, a large diaphragm tube mic. Mm-hmm. And I I remember I did his vocals and his guitar and everything. Every single overdub was the same mic. And I just went back and listened to one of those songs a couple of days ago, and it's really it sounds great. It's really clear and stuff. I would never do that now because it sounds a little too bright on the acoustic guitar to me. A little bit of an edge to it that makes it maybe less warm or such sounding. But you know, it's funny that as you get something new, you're trying it out on everything, right?
Yeah. So you remastered Either Or for this reissue. I'm curious, how much work did it need in your ears, ears?
I didn't do the actual mastering, but I supervised all the remastering and I mixed the bonus disc stuff too. The actual mastering engineer for Either Or is my friend Adam Gonsalves at Telegraph Mastering here in Portland. And he does vinyl cutting and digital based pre-mastering and all that kind of work. And we spent about 3 days over there working on this project, listening to A-Being stuff and really fine tuning and de-clicking little weird sounds and all kinds of work. So it's good to give him some credit, because a lot of times I get credit for things I didn't do. And to say I mastered this would certainly be one of those. I supervised it and I made a lot of, had a lot of input, but it was like amazing the work that he was doing. The hardest part of all of this was to find the closest to the original tapes. Back then, like a lot of people were, they were mixing to DAT tapes, digital audio tapes.
Mm-hmm.
And these are horrible, 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 evil little things. If someone doesn't know, they look like a miniature VHS tape kind of.
I remember those. Yeah.
And you'd record two tracks of audio to it. And supposedly it's kind of around, it's same, similar quality to CD. It technically could be some cases a better quality because, it would sample like 18 bit instead of 16 or what have you, or 48K instead of 44.1, the CD rate. But the hardest thing was, that this record had been all, everything had been mixed to DAT at some point. And certainly some of the DAT tapes aren't in our archive. We just don't know where they are. And the other thing that was really difficult is there's at least two places on the album where, as far as I can tell from interviewing Rob Schnapp and people like that that worked on it, and from what I can tell from my just sort of forensic archive work, is that they flew elements of the songs in for a final mix during the mastering. Do you follow what I'm saying?
Yeah, kind of.
So like if you listen to the song Angelus, it starts with like the high little lonesome organ tone.
Mm-hmm.
And the actual mix of that song does not have an organ at the beginning. And if you listen to the Angelus version that's on the Speed Trial 7-inch, that's the mix as it was done without an organ at the top. And in the album, there's an organ introing, which I think is a brilliant move. Obviously, it sets a tone. It's very cinematic. And that organ is actually flown in from another session that happened in Hoboken, like in the 96 or something.
Wow.
When Elliot just spent a couple, like a day at Waterfront Studios, Henry Hirsch's studio, with a friend of mine named Greg DeJesu, who would just track three songs with him, a cover of 13, that Alex Chilton song.
Mm-hmm.
And two of the songs Elliot had been working on, and one was Angelus. And so somehow they must have had, back then what you do a lot is you would take a DAT tape, and if you wanted stems, you would just print a pass of the mix and mute everything except for the organ and then the acoustic guitar, And so some, you could hand those to like a remixer sometimes. This is how a lot of work was being done. Strangely enough. So you'd hand them to a remixer or somebody and they would fly them in, nilly-willy and whatever, and try to line them up and make a new version of the song. And so I think they might have printed them like that and had a DAT floating around with these raw materials on it is all we can figure. And Rob Schnapp cannot remember much of anything. I love the guy so much, but he'll admit he's the first person. We were just emailing yesterday about this. He was like, what memory, you know? So he's not, he's like, I think I did that. You know, you have to prompt him and try to figure out. But you know, I mean, at the end it's like, and also in pictures of me, ironically, there's one little tiny guitar figure. I've got the multi-tracks that I were the exact, the original things that I recorded onto in my basement. And you listen, and I remembered, I think I'd kept a cassette of a rough mix of that for a few months after I'd worked on it with him, because I remember when the album came out, I'm like, where'd that other guitar come from? And at some point there's a little sort of backwards sounding guitar figure, descending line, and it's not on the multi-track. It's not anywhere. So I was like, it's like, I tried to even make a new mix of it just to see if I could make it sound better with, without changing it. And I couldn't get that guitar figure to show up, you know? So there's a lot of things like that, and sourcing the material to master from. We had to go to some of the actual masters that were done back then. So that was kind of a strange, it felt kind of backwards, you know what I mean? Like we weren't actually able to completely undo the mastering. But, you know, the mastering guy who did that was, I got to dig his name up. I'm totally forgetting all of a sudden. Don Tyler at Precision. So, you know, 20 years ago, the mastering quality, the quality of converters and a lot of the stuff like that was still sort of slightly in its infancy. And then that was the one thing. It was like we were even able just to get better sound, you know, off the DAT tapes or into the analog mastering process, you know, than they were able to do back then. And it was kind of cool. It felt like we'd lifted a sort of sonic veil off of some of these tracks, you know?
Yeah. So I got to ask you, you mentioned some tracks Elliot recorded while he was under contract with DreamWorks. There's a bunch of unreleased stuff here. How many unreleased complete Elliot Smith tracks are there that haven't seen the light of day yet?
I don't know, because I don't have access to all the vaults for Universal. I know there's stuff there, and there's stuff that there's basically two, I guess legally, there's two collections of Elliot Smith material, and one would be anything that's outside of the Universal contract, which basically is everything except for XO, Figure Eight, and the outtakes of those and the outtakes of Basement on a Hill and anything recorded from 1998 on, like a live show, anything that happened is owned by the major label, but everything before that basically, and the cop and the actual songs on Basement on a Hill are owned by his family, in, or say in the case of Heat Miser, jointly the family and the guys from the band. So, you know, there's still, like, you know, stuff that's unreleased technically, that's under their control, the family's control. But, you know, after doing New Moon, after putting some extra songs on Heaven Adores You soundtrack, and then some extra songs on this compilation or this bonus disc thing, I mean, it's not like, you know, there's an amazing unheard album or something.
Got it.
You know? Yeah, I mean, it's odds and ends. I mean, I think even like some of his lesser works are quite interesting. There's a song called Cecilia Amanda, which you can, that was an official download from Kill Rock Stars a while back. And it turned out it was a reworking of a song from his high school band.
Wow.
Called Stranger Than Fiction back in the 80s or whatever. So, you know, I mean, that's just like musically kind of interesting, but not on a par with what he was doing later, you know?
Yeah.
So there's that kind of situation happens a lot.
Yeah. Do you knew him for several years? Did you see his guitar playing kind of transform, or was he kind of always, I mean, you know, some of the stuff he does, like that song Tomorrow Tomorrow, is just like so hard to play. It's amazing that, you know, he's able to both write those lyrics as well as play the guitar that well.
Yeah. I mean, it was weird. I remember him practicing sometimes, like when we first opened the studio. He did a show after Either Or came out. He did a show at La Luna in the balcony, and I did the live sound for that. And I remember him rehearsing for that show. I remember him learning like Waterloo Sunset and stuff like that to play that night. You know, but I think The funny thing about that guy is like the sort of thing where he would sit down and play a whole drum part, right? But you'd never see him practicing drums. And it was kind of like that with the, like, keyboards, organ, piano, bass. You never saw him practice these things, you know? And I think he'd already done all the work. Do you know what I mean?
It's wild.
I think he'd already, you know, I think the guitar playing, he just really had worked and worked and worked hard at it when he was young, like in his teenage years. The piano had come from lessons from all the way back to when he lived in Texas and such. And drums, the other students from Lincoln High School said he would like skip out of class and they'd hear him, you know, down the hall in the band room just playing drums over and over and over when he was a teenager. So, I mean, I think he'd kind of already put the work in. The guitar playing, yeah, I mean, Tomorrow Tomorrow is a great example. People don't pick up on it how crazy that is, you know, or Pizzola or some of these others. And just the sort of accuracy like on a good night at a good show, like the bonus disc on the Either Or has like five songs or such that are live, and yeah, five songs, and you know, some of you hear Angelus and you hear some of this stuff where it's just really busy, you know, or even like Pictures of Me where he's playing, he's trying to fill in all the parts that are missing on his recorded arrangement, you know, with just his acoustic guitar, and you know, he does a good job. So the dynamics, the movement, the bass lines, all those kind of things. And I think he'd built up his skills to a point, and it was just all there to serve his songs, you know?
It's amazing.
It didn't seem to trouble him. He didn't seem to feel like, I never noticed him like, you know, struggling or, you know, you'd hear him stop at a show sometimes. He'd go, oh shit. Okay. Here one more time. You know, but, you know, the thing I always tell people is he'd put the work in. He'd really spent the time trying to get better at everything, including lyrics, of course.
Yeah. So I think I saw in the bowels of the EMP a couple years ago his upright piano. Where did his guitar end up? Do you know?
I think his family has it.
Yeah.
I thought that his father might have it. Or one of his half sisters. I don't know. It's funny because to me that stuff just doesn't. I guess I'm just sort of like pragmatic or something. Never think about those things. I was the one that sold the piano to the EMP because it wouldn't stay in tune. So, you know.
You got a good deal on it, I bet.
Yeah, you know, I think I sold it to the EMP for about the same price he bought it for. So, okay. You know, kind of traded it over. It's going to be starting in March. The EMP is now called the Pop something.
Yep.
They renamed it, right? Yeah.
They did rename it.
Pop Culture Museum or something. Anyway, so I just got an email 2 days ago, and in March it's going to be in an exhibit. And because I went over there when they were doing Baby Britain, I have one photo of Elliot playing that damn piano. But actually, there's video of him playing it from the Strange Parallel documentary that they shot, kind of a promo documentary. And they threw together a video for, I think, Waltz Number 2 using that same footage, even though it wasn't the same song that he was playing. So there's shots of him playing the piano and video too. But
cool.
Yeah, you know, it was a kind of a cool, I like the EMP. I thought it was a real interesting place, you know, and seeing some of Jack and Dino's old recording equipment there has kind of inspired me and to get some of Elliot's things there. And they actually, one of the things they have is his old tape deck, the Tascam 38, the model that we both had versions of. And I think at that point it was actually kind of a Frankenstein tape deck because we scavenged parts from both decks, but, I sold them that and I sold them the piano and then bought a new piano.
I'm glad to hear it's going to see sunlight cause it was kind of down there with, all sorts of random stuff. So that's great to hear.
Oh yeah. Yeah. About 400 broken, Cobain guitars, right?
I think I was next to King Tubby's console actually.
Oh man, shit. See, that'd be my museum, right?
Yeah.
Oh man. Yeah, it was funny to sell it to him. I felt kind of like weird, but you know, I talked to his family. I made sure that was okay and that kind of stuff. I don't want to ever, you know, I don't want to ever have his family or Kill Rock Stars or anyone think that I'm being opportunistic or anything, cuz I'm compensated for my work on the the archive stuff and working for Kill Rock Stars when they do a release, and there's no reason I want to, you know, go out. And I get interviews and publicity from all this too, so there's no reason I would ever go and try to cheapen that out or something.
Yeah, well, I want to talk to you about that because it's the 20th anniversary of Either Or, but also apparently Jackpot. Congratulations.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Yeah, I can't believe it.
How, 5-10 years ago, everybody was talking about how home recording is going to destroy recording studios. How is it for you guys, and what's your secret?
Well, that's I don't think it's home recording that's changed us. The one thing you always have to, and I'm always defending home recording because that's where I started too, but the one thing you got to realize is it isn't so much home recording is being utilized for things that would never be done in a recording studio. Like nobody would come spend $750 a day to come work with me on some of these sort of just side project or fun things that people are doing. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's just a misunderstanding a lot of times. Like if you're trying to make a record that's really going, you're trying to get attention, you want it to be, you know, like say a lot of the stuff I do gets played on college and nonprofit radio and stuff, right? If you're trying to get things on the radio, even at that level, there's got to be some sort of sonic interest. It can't be just completely garbage sounding. You know, I mean, there's an intent. There's another side of this that's not true, where Guided by Voices or sure, what have you live. But then that means it's got to be balanced out by just incredibly good melodies.
Yeah.
You know? So, I think it's kind of a misunderstanding a lot of times in my mind that people look at it as if, the fact that it's easier now to set up a home recording system with a laptop that you probably already own or such. It doesn't mean that someone's going to immediately start tracking like a, you know, rock band with drums and it's going to sound good, because that's so much more equipment and work and recording space and all these things that are just not that easy to set up, you know?
Yeah.
And so one of the things I knew right away was that you don't, if you see a change in a marketplace like this or whatever, you don't fight it. You learn to offer things that they can't do, you know? I mean, and the things that you get in a studio like Jackpot or, you know, in Seattle there, you've got some of my favorite studios like Avast and Litho and all these great places, London Bridge, is you offer things like, you know, consoles that they could, nobody, you know, unless they were rich, they can't afford to have in their home. You know, we've got my console's cheap. It's a $56,000 console. You know, you go to London Bridge or Avast or Litho, and these things are way more expensive even than mine. And, in having, you know, tape decks, I have a 2-inch 16, a 2-inch 24, a 1/4-inch mixed down deck. You know, these are things that are just kind of outside the realm of most home studios. You know, and everything's running, by the way. That's one of the points.
Yeah.
Everything works. And, you know, and then, you know, we have like $8,000 mics, $5,000 mics. And it's just that investment. And we have a dedicated room that sounds great on drums and instruments. And we have headphone mixers and people can mix their own headphones. And, so you think about how are you going to do this at home? Say you have a loudish rock band, you know, and you want to record your album. It's like, you can do that at home, but are you going to get like a really good drum room sound, you know, in your home? Sometimes you can, you know, sometimes you can't, you know, what if you got kids? Are you going to be able to do this quietly, you know? And it's like, I think a lot of people realize that just to get the job done right, or even on time, or at a certain level of sonic quality, it is not that easy, you know, but it can be done anywhere and anyhow, but it's just a matter of like, you know, how many mic preamps do you need just to record a drum kit, you know?
Yeah.
How many thousands of dollars is that really going to cost you?
Well, and I was looking at your rates online, and you've got a 10-hour day with the house engineer for only $550. That seems really cheap.
Mm-hmm. I hope so. I mean, you know, but other times you tell people that rate and they get all like, whoa, geez, oh, I can't do that. And then, you know, I don't understand, because, you know, you have access to like the most up-to-date version of Pro Tools and you know, Burl converters, all this high end equipment. You know, I mean, if you go to Guitar Center and spend $550, you're not going to get much recording equipment.
No. Are you guys pretty busy?
Right now, you know, we started the year like it looked terrible.
Yeah.
And or like, you know, right after Christmas. And we've got Jerry Joseph and the Jack Mormons in there right now. I'm going to start mixing that record for them on Saturday. But they've been in there for off and on for a year doing this really amazing record with Dave Schools from Widespread Panic producing and stuff. And we've got a band called Married Young from the UK coming in the beginning of February for 31 days, you know, to record, and all sorts of other projects after that. So, you know, I can't complain. It just sort of was weird. For a minute, the calendar was empty and then it wasn't again.
Yeah.
So you got to say that's pretty nice.
And then you also have Tape Op still, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. That's 21 years now coming up on, you know, that they were kind of both started around the same time, 96 and 97 in my life. And, you know, it's the very parallel growth, you know, a lot of the recording equipment that I've ended up with, has been, you know, things that I've seen at trade shows cause I had to go for the magazine or something I might've reviewed and then said, hey, can I buy this? And, so there's been like a real nice parallel growth. I mean, my studio is, if you look at the gear list, is very much oriented towards new boutique pro audio companies, you know, especially smaller ones. You know, I don't have an SSL. I don't have anything by not much by really large companies. It's a lot of things like Burl and the Rupert Neve Designs and Chandler and all Great River, all these wonderful companies that make really good products.
Yeah, just as the world of guitars that we cover has all these boutique makers doing awesome stuff, it seems like the audio.
Oh yeah,
even bigger probably. And you guys, I mean, you were a huge inspiration on the Fretboard Journal, so thank you. I just re-upped my.
I'm incredibly honored by something like that because I Fretboard Journal is one of three magazines I've subscribed to. So, so to me, it's like, you know, it's like, oh, look at this, like I can read it because it's really full of content, you know?
Oh, thank you. Well, same with you guys. I mean, to see Tape Op and see it evolve and really it being you and John and kind of, it was a eye-opening experience for me starting out of like, okay, this can be done with a couple of guys and willpower and a lot of burning totally. The midnight oil. Like it's doable.
Yeah. You know, and not working in a model of like, the way publishing companies work and, you know, setting up an office full of people and delegating little jobs. I mean, everything we do, John and I own it, John Bacigalupi and I own it. And, everything we do is basically like if someone's working for us, they're either on commission, like for ad sales or they're subcontractors, you know?
Yep.
So there's really nobody working full time on the magazine besides maybe John. you know, I work in the studio and then I plan out, I have on my calendar all through the year when I have to kind of make sure I take time to get a magazine issue ready. And then I'd go back into sessions and it's always like that all year.
Yeah.
And we have a great staff, which helps with all the extra stuff around it, but staying away from that model of like, you know, big time publishing, how it used to be, you know, even Mix Magazine now doesn't have a central office as far as I can tell. And we kind of started that way. Like we don't pay for office rent, you know, we don't pay for some of the things you would think that a journalist would have to have around them, you know?
Yeah. And you guys have an especially unique model in that, anyone listening to this and anyone could subscribe for free, which is pretty cool.
In the US, yeah. And then, yeah. And internationally you can get free PDFs, of course, all you need is an email. So it's, you know, it's pretty easy to get into someone's hands, and that's all advertiser supported. Like all the kind of companies I mentioned earlier, you know, they're running ads and Tape Op, and that covers the production costs and everything. And we pay the writers from that and all that. And, you know, so it's a different model. I mean, I know like with Fretboard Journal, it is more of a journal model where it's like, you know, subscriptions are not inexpensive, but it's a higher quality paper stock and on printing, the photos are beautiful. Whereas we go with the thin paper so we can ship them cheaper. And, you know, we don't even ship them with a cover or an envelope, you know? So yeah. you have a different, you just, you provide sort of a different thing based on the economics of how you're doing it. But we can reach a larger amount of people by being, producing them cheaper, you know?
Totally. Yeah. For us, it was just, you know, practically I hate selling ads. So I kind of wanted our readers to support that. Take the burden off of us.
If you look at something like Surfer's Journal, that's another good example of working the way you guys are working, and making a high quality product and focusing on, I mean, I would assume nobody gets Fretboard Journal, reads it and throws it in the recycling bin.
No one does. Yeah. Yeah. If anything, they'll flip it on eBay and make a profit.
Yeah, yeah. You know what they do is they steal it from my studio is what happens.
Okay.
Those bastards. I think I had like all the early issues, and I went and looked the other day. I'm like, where'd they go? Interesting.